Monday, May 20th, 1991, in Robertsville, Indiana, just 3 days after the city of Robertsville had several tornadoes hit on the north, on the west and north side of town, which did considerable damage. And we're just happy we have power to be able to do these interviews. This is another in a series of interviews with veterans of World War II. And we've had some real good interviews, and we know that today will be no exception. These tapes, interviews really started from an idea that we picked up off from watching the Civil War, stories about the Civil War that were on the PBS a few months ago. And they were, Ken Burns was the narrator, and showed pictures of people 50 years ago fought in the Battle of Gettysburg and had whiskers clear down to here. And so far we haven't had any people who were in the World War II about 50 years ago that have long chin whiskers like that. These interviews will be placed in the library. They're property of the Montgomery County Historical Society. My name is Clark Chamberlain. I live here in Crawfordsville. A member of the American Legion and the VFW. Our cameraman is Ed Miller, a member of the American Legion and the VFW. Another gentleman who really started this whole idea to get this done, and we're glad he did, is Bob Wernley, semi-retired attorney here in Crawfordsville. We've also had a lot of help from Mike Hall. We're taping from the Lane Place in Crawfordsville, and Mike is the executive director, so to speak, or manager here at the Lane Place. Today, we'll now start our interview, and if I could, sir, what is your name?
William Morgan. They call me Woody.
They call you Woody.
Right.
I see.
I got that from the baseball player, the Chicago Cubs.
Oh, Woody Ailey. Well, he was a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, where were you born, Woody?
I was born in Wayland. I was born November the 1st, 1918.
I see.
And my mother relayed the story to me that I was one of nine babies that week in Montgomery County, and I was the only one survived because of the flu epidemic.
Oh, I see.
And in fact, I didn't live at home for 30 days. An old lady, neighbor lady took me and kept me for 30 days because my mother had the flu when I was born. So consequently, I had to start two homes.
Yeah. Who were your parents, Woody?
Stanley and Morgan and Stella Morgan Davis. Stanley was originally from Hart County. My mother was from Wayland.
Mm-hmm. What was her maiden name?
Scott. She was, her father fought in the Civil War. And he came home from the war, but his buddy got killed. And his buddy told him before he died that he said, when you go home, take care of my wife, Mary, which later became my grandmother, and he did. He married her. And that's kind of ironic, you know, that his wife died after he got home, and then he married my grandmother.
So. You know, it is ironic.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Do you have brothers and sisters?
Oh, yes. There was 12 in our family.
Oh, my goodness.
And there was 8 boys and 4 girls.
Where were you in the line of...
I was seventh child.
Seventh child.
I guess that has to be considered lucky. No, I said
seventh. Right. Where'd you go to school?
I went to school at Wayland High School. Then I transferred to Brazil in the last couple of years. And stayed down there until later on. Moved up on a farm by Hillsborough. And they closed the mine down because of a strike. And I worked in a coal mine. Which is an experience I'm glad I had. I know how coal miners had to live.
Yeah.
They all mine coal all week and go in town and drink beer on Saturday night and tell about how much coal they mined that weekend.
Right. After school, did you graduate from high school?
No, I just withdrawn. I was due. I had to, because of the economic situation, I just could not go any further. I had to go to work.
Where'd you go to work?
In the coal mines. Mm-hmm. I lived in Brazil at that time.
I see.
In the coal mines.
Then what did you do?
Well, then I worked at Turkey Run State Park in the hotel for 4 years after that. And I drove a taxi here in Crawfordsville in the wintertime when I'd get laid off.
About what year would this be, Woody?
1937 through 1941. till September 41 when I went into service. So I worked for 4 years in the summertime from about April till about 1st of November, and then I would come back to Carlsville. I'd go to the camp or the yellow cabinet making the wintertime. Didn't get much money, $1 a day, 7 days a week.
That'd go a long way.
But I survived. That's all you had to do, then, was survive.
Right. When did you have ideas about going in the military?
Well, I was a turkey around. There was three of us that decided we was going to visit a friend of ours that had been drafted from Turkey Run. He was in the Army, and we went down to see him at Camp Lee, Virginia. And when I went in down there, I was so depressed from seeing what was going on around there. It was depressing. And in fact, this friend of ours, when he saw us come to visit, he just broke down and cried. He was so happy to see it. Mm-hmm. And when I left, I went into service September 16th. This was the first week in September. I knew that I was
41.
I knew that I was not going in the Army, nothing. I mean, it just depressed me to see what I saw. And I always wanted to go in the Navy anyway, because it was a fellow from Wayland, Raymond Hanna, had gone into the Navy, and he used to talk to me about it. It excited me when I was a kid, still on the streets. In fact, he was lost overboard down around Cuba someplace. And so I decided when I come back, I was going to go into the Navy. And I went to Terre Haute to enlist down there, because that was a turkey run. They didn't have a Navy recruiting office here. So they took me in. And on the 16th of September, I enlisted, and they sent me to Great Lakes Naval Training Station. At that time, they only had 6,000 people there in the Camp Barry. And before the war was over, they had 150,000. So it grew quite a lot while I was in. So then I went to school in Connecticut after.
Let's go back to boot camp a little bit. What did you do in boot camp?
Well, I almost got killed there. The guy was taking these heaving lines and practice and throwing them, and he just missed my head just about that much. I could hear the wind off of when it went by. And we did a lot of training and drilling and marching. Disciplinary work was absolutely, it was one way to get disciplined, because if you didn't do right, you had to get out and march and run around the field. And I know, for instance, one time the guy didn't salute the flag in the evening, and I saw this old chief have him out here just running him back and forth till he finally dropped. He couldn't run no more. But I felt that was a little bit harsh, you know. I felt it, but I wasn't involved in it.
Yeah. When did you leave Great Lakes then?
The reason I remember when we left, I was told to go to school in Connecticut at Cooks and Baker School in Connecticut in Roden Heights. And my brother's birthday was on the 3rd, and we got there on the 3rd. That's the reason why I remember December the 3rd, before Pearl Harbor on December the 7th. And I didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was, you know. I just knew in the Navy and had been around. But an old chief told me where it was. It was in Honolulu. And I was pretty well saddened with all the casualties we had. Mm-hmm. One reason I went in boot camp, I was with a young fellow. He told me his brother was stationed aboard the USS Shaw in Pearl Harbor. And the brothers could go together at that time. And so he joined his brother, which he did. And I always wondered, he had just about had time to get there, if he did get there. I never saw him again. And I happened to know a fella that was on the USS Shaw that was stationed with me at Floyd Gunn Field. And I asked him if he knew this kid. He said he didn't know. He said we had so many casualties, I didn't. He said if he just knew aboard ship, I wouldn't have known him. Mm-hmm. So I always wondered what ever happened. But I never saw him anymore.
I see. So, okay, you're in Connecticut at Cook and Baker School.
Cook and Baker School.
How did they happen to select you to be at Cook and Baker?
I think because I worked the turkey run and done a little cooking down there, and busboy work, and worked around food, and they thought I'd be a good cook. But I come out all right. In the end, I was the chief commissary steward before it was all over. Not at that school, but
yeah.
Before the end of my
career. How long were you in the Cook and Baker School?
I was there from December 3rd till March, the middle of March, I think it was. It was in March.
Mm-hmm. What'd you do in that school? Just practice?
Oh, we took training in how to cook. They had old-time chiefs that knew how to cook and taught us. And we do different things. Do a little baking, a little cooking, and butchering.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was about 3 months. Yeah, let's see, December, January, February. About 3.5 months.
Okay. Then where did you go?
Then I went to, they sent it down to Floyd Bennett Field. And, they sent it to New York for reassignment out of New York, 3rd Naval District. We got down there and they said they needed two to go to Floyd Bennett Field. Well, we knew where it was because we had gone down to New York a lot. We knew where Floyd Bennett Field was. And so when we said we two of me and Dale Kennedy, buddy of mine, which I still correspond with.
Good.
That's 50 years ago, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so they sent us to Floyd Bennett Field. And they hadn't even completed the place there. They was pumping sand in the alley ocean to make the runways.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed in the Marine Barracks for a while. Then we stayed in the hangar. Then they finally built barracks for the ship's crew to sleep in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there almost 3 years. And,
yeah, is that right?
Yeah. And we had a zone, this airfield, Florida Naval Air Station, had a 500-mile zone that they covered. And they flew all the time because as a cook, I used to have fixed flight rations for the crews to go out and fly all around the clock. Crews would come there and get their food for whatever was going to be out, 7-8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew over this 500-mile zone looking for submarines, and which the Germans had a lot of submarines at that time. I mean, they just knocking our shipping off something terrible. Just our fleet was really losing an awful lot of transport ships and food ships and cargo ships.
Did you ever go up in a plane?
No, I wasn't allowed to go up unless the pilot wanted to take me up. And I had offers to go, but I said, no, thank you, I'll stay on the ground.
Okay.
But I really enjoyed it there because it wasn't as strict discipline there as it was on other places, in the bases, army bases and so on. Due to the fact that the pilots' life and their ships depended upon the crews that maintained them and took care of them and so on. They were gassed up and it was functioning perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And they had big check-off lists where they check everything off, what they had to do, each man, and then they'd go over that list before they let the plane go out to see if there was
problems. What kind of planes were these that did this patrolling?
And, let's see, we had F-4Us mostly. I don't know. I think that's, we had a lot of F-4Us at that
time. That was a fighter plane?
Yeah, they were fighter planes. And they would go out. They had a lot of stamina. They could drop bombs on the submarines.
Did they?
Yeah. Oh, we sank a lot of subs, German subs from our base. That was one way we helped clean them out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There were other airfields from Norfolk and Jacksonville and Florida and Boston, you know, that had their zone to cover. We only had 500 miles, which sounds like a lot, but it's not very, it really isn't that much.
Yeah. And they hit a sub. Now, did you know of a ship ever going out then and picking up prisoners?
No, they never bothered anything.
Or they sunk them.
They sunk them and that's it. They never bothered anything else. They just knew they were sunk. I understand they told me the higher they were, they flew, they could see further down in the water. That was the reason why they used airplanes instead of submarine searches. They had some of them, but not too many. The plane did the damage.
Did you get to know some of the pilots?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did.
What did you think of them?
Oh, I loved them. They were just great guys. You know, I mean, they didn't seem like an Army officer, even though they had their ratings and everything. But they were just...
They were Army officers.
No, Navy officers.
They were Navy officers.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they had their everything from ensign to captain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the pilots, most of them were lieutenants and lieutenant JGs.
Mm-hmm.
They were just They were just nice people. I know one night, I hate to say this, but I was over at a bar. You know, that's where they were going.
I've been in a couple.
And they had this big oval bar. Right across the, on the other side, there's two officers sitting there drinking beer one night. And all at once, I heard a gun go off. And I didn't know what it was. And all at once, I saw this guy slump off of the, this officer slump off of the chair. And he fell on the ground, on the floor, and he was dead. But I never knew whether he accidentally did it or what happened. Nobody knew. All of them, I mean, I saw them talking, you know, like two guys. But they had their weapons with them. Why, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But they had gone off duty. Mm-hmm. And went in there to drink.
Might have had an argument.
They didn't seem to be.
One of the SPDs didn't come from all directions.
Oh, they did, and they shut the bar up right there. They made everybody leave and get out and spend. I didn't see anything wrong, you know. One guy said, well, maybe he committed suicide, but I doubt it. He just didn't seem like that kind of a person. Of course, you never know.
But you never heard one.
They never gave no report on him.
Okay. Very interesting. Is there anything else you want to tell us about your duty at Floyd Benfield? Anything spectacular, like any famous people that came through there, or
they used to come out the baseball teams in spring training when they come back to Florida would come out and play Floyd Benfield's baseball team, and we had to cook a meal for them: steaks, French fries, salads for the. All the Giants players there, I think it was 2 years in a row, 42, 43. Mm-hmm. So I got to see the old players like Melhoff and different.
Oh, did you?
People would know who Melhoff was, but the better Giants probably wouldn't.
Yeah.
But that was exciting and interesting.
Okay. Well, where did you go from Floyd Benfield then?
Well, I went down to Norfolk, Virginia for reassignment. And they already had me picked to go on this destroyer mine layer. And when I went aboard that ship, we were out down there all summer in Norfolk, and I hated that place. Mm-hmm. I can honestly say they said that on the average of a suicide a week on the Navy base there, it was that bad. Mm-hmm. And I never even went in county one time, and I stayed on the base. Mm-hmm. For my entertainment, whatever it was. And I was always in trouble with somebody. You're supposed to have your pants legs down, you know. And we'd go chow, I'd roll them up so the rain would splatter on them. And who would have an interview with the commander of the base? And he'd walk up, tap you on the shoulder, say, "Look, roll your pants legs down." And that's all. And then later on, I saw him over in the mess hall. They had this mess hall where everybody went over and ate their lunch. And so I said to these guys that I was with, I said, they had a whole, but several chairs, all tables all lined up for the officers. I said, there's nobody here. They never come in here. I said, let's just sit here. We didn't have any place else to sit, but we hadn't even worked. I sat down. Here come the commanding officer and the whole crew and their wives and everybody through there. He walked up to me and he said, "You again?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You know you're not supposed to be here." And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Go ahead and finish your snack here and then don't get in here anymore." He said, "I don't want to ever see you in there again." But I couldn't get away from him. He was always around me for some reason, and I don't know why. It was that way.
Okay. Keep talking. Tell us more about your ship now.
Oh, well, I went aboard this destroyer mine layer. They sent us up to New York to get Brooklyn Navy Yard to go aboard this, a whole new crew. We were down there for training.
Was it a new ship, too?
Yeah, it was a new one. It was this destroyer mine layer. They only had 11 of them in the whole service in the Navy, and I went on this one. We went aboard the naval, this ship here, and then we went on a shakedown cruise, and we went down to Bermuda for that. While we were down there, I remember one thing very distinctly. We lost two men overboard. The water was awful rough down there in Cape Hatteras, that's where we were. And so I saw these guys. I went out to take some egg crates out on the deck and sitting out there after a drill we had. We just had a drill, Jim McCord's drill. And I was a cook and all these late crates and everything was in the way. So I just went out and sat on the deck. I was going to have the mess cook take us to the back of the ship where we put all our stuff. And back on the fantail. So that little ship started going down right when I turned around. It started going down, down, down. I reached in there and I grabbed a hold of a railing. And water was up around my knee. I looked around and there was those egg crates and all that stuff floating out to sea. And I looked up and I saw somebody going by. You know, I said, my God, somebody got washed overboard. And so I didn't have my life jacket on. But that's the last time I ever went on deck without my life jacket. I could just see me out there. Well, these two guys, Chief Gunner's mate, and another one of his assistants was washed overboard. And we searched for hours for him, and we never did find him. So finally, another ship picked him up late that afternoon. They could see him. They just happened to come right up on him a little bit.
They did take him.
Yeah, they saved him. And one guy had just been married 2 weeks, and I talked to him when he came back aboard. He told me that he had one of these life jackets on, you blow up. And he said, I took my shoes off and fought off these man of wars. There was time to attack me. And he said, I looked over and there was a chief over there. He had a Mae West life jacket on, and he was injured. He said, and I went over and helped him and stayed with him until we were picked up by some landing craft was down there on Shakedown. That's where we were. So they finally got him, and I never saw him anymore until I went on the USS Bountiful. I was in a bar one night, and here he come in, this chief. I hadn't seen him since. I said, where you been? You left the ship a long time, didn't you? He said, that was a terrible experience for me.
Oh, that it was.
He said, my shoulder was broken. He said, I was in the hospital for a long time with that. And this other kid, he'd only been married 2 weeks before we went on the Shakedown. He was happy to be back aboard.
What was the name of your ship?
The J. William Ditter. It was named Ditter, D-I-T-T-E-R.
Okay.
It was named after a senator from Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I remember that, but...
How big was it? How many men, for example, did you have?
We had about 300 men and 20 officers. So we had a complement of 320 altogether. And it was about 30 feet wide. It was only, I think, about 300 feet long or something like that.
Yeah, what was the armament on it?
We had on the front of the ship, out on the bow, we had 2 5/8 gun mounts. And then we had our 440 millimeter twin that I was on, millimeter, at the side. And then we had the P-50 caliber, and then we had twin 40 millimeters on the fantail. I think we had 1 5/8 gun back there, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And then the mine tracks is all we had. Mm-hmm. We didn't have too much firepower. We had quite a lot. And when we went to Okinawa, they decided to put us out on radar picket duty. That was the intercept all the planes from.
Okay, you're still now at New York or Norfolk?
Norfolk.
Okay.
And
when did you leave Norfolk?
Let's see. I think it was late November, we went back to New York.
No, 1948.
We went back to Norfolk. With the ship, we went back to Norfolk. That was 1944.
All right.
So, at that time, it was 45 because we sailed and went to ship right after that. So we got out there in 45, but this was in early 45. And when we left to go to the Pacific, we got through the canal and around San Diego.
What did you think of that?
That was a wonderful experience.
Tell us about it.
Well, the one thing I remember most was I had no idea what the canal looked like. And I didn't know it was kind of a river that went all the way through after you got through the locks. And the one thing I remember was I saw an old black lady in a little old boat, just it looked like it maybe about 10 feet long. And she had oars, and she had full bananas. I don't know where she got them. I suppose they're in the jungle someplace. And she thought we were going to hit her. She was just roaring, just yeah. She could go get away from us. And then it was hot. Oh, it was hot. And Panama was dirty. It, like all the countries down in there. It was just, I wouldn't use anything like that. Mm-hmm. And the trip through was nice, but I was glad it was over. And I've never been back since.
Yeah.
And we went around through the canal.
And where'd you go?
To San Diego. I really remember pulling in San Diego. And the weather was cold when we left, about 15 above zero and 6 inches of snow in Norfolk. We got around there and it was, they had newspapers out on the docks. And I went out and got one and come back and sit down on the mine track to read the newspapers. I opened it up and said, Midwest hit with blizzard. And it's telling about how deep the snow was and how bad it was here. I'm sitting there, skimmy shirt, reading the paper, didn't seem possible. But I
how long did you stay in San Diego?
We weren't there but about 4 or 5 days, and then we took off and we got supplies and kind of relaxed a little.
And you headed for Okinawa?
No, we went to Hawaii.
Okay.
And we was there 3 or 4 days. We took us about 5 days to get out to Hawaii. And we had, that was where we had our camouflage painted on our ship in Hawaii. I don't know why, but it took a long time. Then we went from there to Aniwetok. And the thing that I remember going to Aniwetok was, I was out on the deck one day, up at my gun, that's where I usually spent all my time off. And so I was there at the, sat there looking out, and all at once I saw a submarine come up. We was escorting an aircraft carrier to Aniwetok.
You know which one it was?
I can't remember which one it was now.
Okay.
Just because we escorted so many of them. And while we was there, I saw a submarine come up. And I couldn't believe it. You know, first time I'd ever seen a real live Japanese submarine. So I said to the gunner, I said, hey, look there, there's a submarine. Is that a submarine? He said, yeah. And he hollered at the gunner officer on the telephone, on the earphones, and told him. And all at once again, general quarters went off. And that old aircraft carrier took off. And the other destroyer on the other side, there was two destroyers escorting them. They fell back right behind us, between us and the aircraft carrier, and they took off. And then we had orders to search out and destroy the submarine, which we did. We dropped, I think it's 40 depth charges in that one area. Finally, the old oil and everything started coming up. And we got credit for that submarine. And then we was to meet the ship the next day in a certain area, certain place, and we did. Of course, you know, they had ways of, you go sail in a certain spot and everybody's there that wants to be. So we continued to escort the ship on the Aniwetok. And we went, that's just a small island you can see right over it.
Mm-hmm.
And all the crew that supplied us with fuel, we refueled there. And they were, in fact, they'd been there, I think, maybe about 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
They were really looked the part.
Mm-hmm.
And they was glad to see somebody, you know. And so we stayed there and we talk. Then they sent us down to the equator, but we didn't get to cross it. We was 30 miles from the equator, but the captain, he said, I don't want to fool with that stuff now. You guys celebrate, killing each other.
Right.
So he went across it. So we went from there to Ulithi. I don't know if you ever heard of that or not, but it was what they called the Pearl Harbor of the Western Pacific.
Okay.
And I was in there one day, and I saw my brother's ship come in there all at once. You know, his ship come in. I knew what his USS Irwin he was on.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to my commanding officer and supply officer first. I wanted to see the captain. He said, okay. I told him my brother's ship come in. I wonder if I can get a boat to go over and see him. Yeah, he said, you might as well. Good. I said, we're not going to be here long anyway. So I went aboard his ship. I told him I didn't know where we were going, and I did. So eventually, I came back to my ship, and then we sailed for Okinawa. I had never heard of Okinawa before, the Ryukyu Islands. And it was about 100,
okay,
almost 300 miles south of Japan.
Did you run into some testing of weapons somewhere along the line? Atomic?
We didn't test any.
I thought you mentioned about seeing an atomic bomb test.
Oh, that was after the war was over.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
All right. I'm getting ahead of you.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead then.
We went up to, we sailed for Okinawa, and they called us down in the mess hall and briefed us on everything, the types of diseases and where we were going, and they had a big map and showed us where we would be, and then we would be cleaning out all the mines so they could have an invasion there. So, I've been down in the gun mount. In the gun mount, I've been in the magazine. That was my battle station. And ammunition, 40 millimeter shells up through the deck to the second loader, and then he'd hammer the first loader, and they'd drop me in the guns. So, I was usually up on in the gun mount quite a lot. The gunner officer was always on to me about it. Said, "You're supposed to be down there." I said, "Well, I know what to do down there. I want to see what's going on up there."
Yeah.
So, anyway, we went to Okinawa. About a day before we got in there, we was practicing our elevating our guns and everything. And this one kid from Indianapolis, he was, I can't think of his name now. Anyway, he was asleep. First gunner, he was asleep. And they elevated the gun, he came down, and he had his leg there, and it matched his knee.
Mm.
So he was unable to perform.
Mm-hmm.
So they was talking about replacing him, and who they were going to get to replace him. And I heard that Splash to say, "Send Morgan up there. He knows as much as anybody does. Said he's up there all the time anyway." But I was glad to get up there because I couldn't stand all that firing. And when I was all enclosed and you couldn't see what was going on, and up there I could see what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So they put him down there in the passageway in the in that hospital bunk, what we call it. It was just regular old Navy bunk, so they just used it for the sick to lay in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took his place. And the next day we got into Okinawa. And we got under real heavy air attack. Kamikaze suicide plane was coming in. I had never seen one before, but I sure did there. And in fact, they had a plane bomber from Japan, or one of our bombers. It was he must have been crippled because he was trying to get into Okinawa to land. That's what he was trying to do. And we was shooting at him, and he dipped his wings, back and forth, trying to let us know that he's friendly plane.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally he landed over there someplace. I never heard of him or anything about him again. But I know the captain gave us 36 hours recognition training after that, so we would know when we were shooting on our planes. But he shouldn't have been in there.
Mm-hmm.
Really, he had no business in there. And so that was the first day we had I saw them planes being shot down, and some of them would dive on us, and they'd go right down in the water, and you never see them again. They just kill them on the gears.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them would hit the water and bounce way up in the air. And
mm-hmm.
Of course, the ones we hit would always explode.
Did your ship get credit for hitting some of these planes?
Oh, yes.
How many?
I think we wound up hitting 26 planes all together in the 3 months we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't there. I think it was 26 planes and one submarine, and then little mini subs they had there in the bay. We got
what date are we talking about?
We're talking the invasion. We went up there in March of 26th to sweep
45
the mine, 45 to sweep these mines, and then we April 1st was the invasion day, and that's when really broke loose all the firepower. You never saw nothing like it. We had 1,500 ships there, and I think they all unloaded on that. So on the island, well, we didn't have any casualties the first 3 days. because I knew it was...
On your ship?
No, on the beach.
I see.
Because when they landed on there, and they went in free, they didn't have... We cleaned that beachhead out really good. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's a funny thing. We can sail there, but by being on the mine circuit, we had to go right up as close as we could get to the shore. Mm-hmm. And get the mines that they had.
Did you get mines?
Oh, yeah. We used to blow them up.
And how did you blow them up?
With our 40 millimeter gun rounds. I mean, with our 40 millimeter.
In other words, you visually spotted them?
Yeah.
And then you shot them and you hit a horn? And
the mine sweepers would sweep them. And they come to the surface.
How did you sweep them? What mechanism would?
They had a big arm on the side of it that you go so deep and they just go in strips like a lawnmower. If you're going to mow a yard, you just go so many strips. They go about 20 feet. Then another mine sweeper right behind them would go. And these, the mines would come up and we'd shoot at them.
Why wouldn't this arm, why wouldn't that?
All that
ignite. Why wouldn't that ignite?
It could, but it didn't. I mean, all they were interested in was cutting the cable that held it.
Oh, it cut the cable.
It cut the cable. That's all it was. They hold these mines under the water, the cables. We cut the cables and they float to the top.
I see. Okay.
So then they would just be laying out there and they had to be destroyed. So these are 40 millimeter guns. Mm-hmm. Last time we couldn't get all of them. We'd have to leave them there all night and go back the next day. Yeah, we go over what they call the Cromarella Islands, about 15 miles in there. A big bunch of island, like a horseshoe cave. Only it's open on both ends, you can go past through.
Was this in Buckner Bay?
No, this was 15 miles away from there. We had to get out at night because those planes, they come in there and get us out there. You know, it was all full of, we couldn't operate in where the minefield was because they'd be floating around, we'd hit them.
Yeah.
So we withdrew and go to these two Cromarell Islands, 15 miles away. And we had little boats. Each ship would have boats and they'd get out and make smoke and cover you over with smoke so that suicide planes couldn't see you. They knew we were in there and they'd get in low and fly down. You could hear them come by, you know. Mm-hmm. They'd fly in there trying to hit somebody. But we'd stay there all night and then we'd go back the next day and finish blowing up the mines that we left. And that was a long procedure.
Yeah.
Over a week of it.
Did you see the landing craft go ashore with the Marines and the...
Oh, no. We were right in.
What was happening? Tell us about that.
Well, they usually had landing craft ships, you know, these, they would, my goodness, thousands of, you know, of troops, but they had hundreds of the ships would carry them in so they could land. And they went in. They really didn't have any casualties for 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Because we had cleaned out all the gun emplacements and run all the jacks out of it off of the beach. They had over 2 million caves on that island. And they go back into their caves and stay there. So consequently, they had a pretty easy landing as far as casualties, there were none. But 3 days later, they started piling up. You know, they come out in caves and mm-hmm. start attacking our troops. Mm-hmm. And
3 days later, what were you doing?
We was out on radar picket duty. They sent us out to intercept suicide planes coming down from Japan. And that was a tough job.
Tell us about it.
Well, we was out there by ourselves. And maybe six...
You mean the only ship out there?
There'd be other ones, but they wouldn't be within 4 or 5 miles of us, you know. We had a certain zone we had to cover. And, it got so bad, we were the 87th destroyer to get hit, that they sent little survivor boats out with us to pick up, you know, sailors that got blown overboard or wounded. And,
on other ships as well as your own?
Yeah. Yeah. So we had quite an ordeal there one day. They used over, the only time that I can remember they used so many planes, they used about 700 of them. And they
used 700. Yeah. You're talking about the Japs?
Yeah. 700 planes, suicide planes, all together during the whole battle. Okinawa, for about 3 months, they used over 2,200 planes, and they lost that many. What we didn't get shoot down, they hit us. But this one ship, I remember, I can't think of the name, but it got hit so bad that from the water level deck, first deck, there was nothing left above, nothing. Actually, I think they only had 8 men that survived. We went alongside to try to see if we could do anything. Nothing we could do, it was all gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they took the, we didn't take them off, but another ship came by and took them to another, I don't know, reassigned them someplace and took them off the ship, and they just towed that old ship in Bunker Bay, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing left to them. And they, let's say they used over 2,000 suicide planes. The greatest naval and sea air battle that ever existed,
right,
in the history of the Navy. And we lost over 300 ships. That was either hit, damaged, or sunk. And we were the 87th destroyer, so we had a lot of casualties. 5,000 injured and 5,000 killed. And I believe the count of Army and Marine was 100,000 casualties. But we had 10,000, and that's a lot of Navy personnel.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And even more than Pearl Harbor.
Well, the two things. Tell us, seeing a kamikaze hit a ship near you, and then tell us about the one that hit you.
Okay. We were out there, we had an air attack one day, and these planes was coming in, and I watched two of these. I didn't know what they were doing. We had a ship that was hit, and he was, they dry docked him over there on the beach. They just beached it, because it was totally destroyed almost. So these planes came over, and they dived into that ship, and there was nobody on it. They took them all the personnel off, and put them on other ships and stations, you know. And I thought I got a kick out of that. Everybody just cheered, you know.
Yeah.
But yet that ship had been hit.
Uh-huh.
But I did see one thing. They had a lot of inexperienced pilots, young, 15, 16, 17 year old boys that just learned how to fly, get the plane in the air and bring it in and attack. And they did some foolish flying.
Mm-hmm.
Really, they did. And they get a lot of ships, but they lost a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
They lost everyone they sent.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you about this one plane we shot down one time. It was late in the evening, it was almost dark. And we shot him down, and so we went over. We saw he did the same, so we went over alongside of him. And they had two pilots in this plane. They were what they called the bedding plane, so why they had them, I don't know. But they had two man crew. One was down on the tail of the ship, and one was surrendered. So the captain, with the tank, he gave us orders to get them out 40 and 41 to destroy the target. And I felt bad about that. I really did. I thought, you know, they're wanting to surrender. But the captain wasn't about to take them. And so we sank them, and they were down. I don't know whatever happened to them, but we never saw them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to tell you one little incident. My brother told me when his ship, the USS Irwin, had shot down a plane, and there was two of them. And one of them came over to surrender, and the other one jumped on his back and stabbed him to death, and then swam away. He would surrender, he wouldn't let his buddy surrender.
Mm-hmm.
He was telling me that.
Well, that's why the captain gave the orders.
Oh, he said, you never know.
You never know.
No. And he was right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt bad about him. Why wouldn't you feel bad? You know, you've been
have
to kill somebody that it just didn't seem right to me. I was trying to surrender, and I hadn't experienced anything like that. But my buddy that was on his hospital ship with me, he was there on the beach at Okinawa, and he told me those Marines used to capture these, had to go and interrogate them, and then the commanding officer said, "Well, take them down to the brig." Well, there was no brig. They take them down, marching down, and they make them squat down in the tree, and then they shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
Shoot them in the guts. Watch their guts roll out. This happened.
Yeah.
And he said, I said, "How did you get away with it?" He said, "Well, they just said that they tried to escape." And there were no more questions asked. This went on. But they did our did, I'm sure.
Yes, sir, they sure did. You couldn't trust them.
No. So, anyway, the old captain called us up, and we remarked about how bad it was. We thought it was, and he called us up in his office the next morning, and he said that in his stateroom, and he said, "I understand you boys are a little unhappy about me having them jets destroyed in that plane last night." I said, "Yeah, I just didn't feel right about it." And he said, "Well, don't worry about it." He said, "Well, if they had come aboard and started throwing hand grenades and killing you or some of your buddies, which they probably would be," he said, "I've been out here a long time in the Pacific, and I don't take no prisoners." So, which, just got another little story to relate to you there. They had all these little suicide boats, you know, one-man crew, and they had them back in these caves. And I saw there one morning, it was almost daybreak, that's when they would attack you, so they could see you, but you couldn't see them very good. Coming out here on this mine track, and this guy jumping in there. And I told the gun girl, I said, "Hey, they're jumping in one of those suicide planes, or boats, not planes." And he said, "Well, we'll get him." So he said, "We got to wait till he gets out here first." So he came out right at us, and we started shooting at him, or he turned and tried to run away from us. And then another destroyer on the port side, one on the starboard side, they went up alongside, and we was right in the center shooting at him. Finally, he hit the boat, and it knocked him out of the water and stunned him. He didn't know what happened, I guess. So we picked him up, and our captain radioed over to the ship, I forget the name of the ship, gives the orders,
Fletcher. Ship.
Fletcher. Said, "We've got a Japanese officer over here. What are you going to do, kill him?" And the officer said, "No, we want to interrogate him." Said, "If he's able to." So he said, "We'll send a boat over after him." So they sent a boat from the army over there to get him. They took him, I don't know where they took him, but he got into the army hands after that. And I don't know whatever happened to him, you know. But they had a lot of them. They had a lot of them little suicide boats. And we got man suicide submarine, one man submarine. We got a couple of them while I was in there. But every day there was action. Every hour.
It sounds like it. Well, tell us about when you got hit, Woody.
Oh, okay. It was just about supper time. And we chowed down supper, got everything out in the mess hall, and some of the guys had just got their trays full and started eating when they had an air attack. So they had to leave it and go to the general quarter station. So that's when I went up to my station, and anyway, we shot down. It's when we hit this here. He comes through there and we hit this two stacks of one just like it, about 20 feet away.
Let's get these and hold them out. If you could look upside down there, Woody, to our cameraman.
Oh, yeah.
And keep off the side so your fingers aren't on it. And as you described them, are you picking them up, Ed?
I had more pictures, but I do not know where they are. I had some good ones. Showed the 52-foot hole. And
Now tell us what we're seeing.
Well, here is where a plane hit there. There was a guy in that post there. He jumped overboard there, all the way down on the deck. He didn't get hit. And the plane went out of the water. That's the only damage this would be. And I'm only just about 20 feet away from this other stack. And I really got scared then. I knew he'd come about as close as he could go. So, anyway.
Now, is that the main one that hit your ship?
No, this is not the main one. Let me see here just a minute. The main one here, the ship made a 52-foot hole outside of this wall. But this hatch here came off and got blew off in the engine room, right under. And it hit my chief commissary straight in the head. He was running down the passway, and he wasn't supposed to be there. He ran from his battle station. I read the letter the captain wrote to his wife. I saw her in New York when I went back, and it wasn't very complimentary.
What happened to him?
Oh, he was killed instantly. That hatch hit him right there, and he killed him instantly. They laid him out on the back foot, banged him. Mm-hmm. And this is the repair ship. There's not much to see here, so I won't show that. Here's another picture of that we're going to get. That's a second one.
Okay. Now, tell us about...
Well, we still have a little thing about this air attack.
Okay.
I look back behind this, here, and I saw two planes coming in from the rear.
Okay, show that again.
This is... I saw two planes coming in there, and, these gunhouse back here shot them down. There's two guns back there, one on the port side, one, and they shot them down. They just missed our ship by inches. They just went kind of burned up, went right in.
Missed you to hit them.
Yeah, we didn't hit the guy in the gun crew at the back of the gun. And let's see now here. Well, anyway, in the meantime, I looked out over the water and I saw a plane. Was flying about 5 feet above the water. They always have one good pilot drill all the rest of them in, and then they report back to Japan. And he saw that they were all gone but him. So he decided to make an attack on us. And I won't relate one story here, that they used to cut off a finger or part of their ear to give to their parents when they went, and they had a little celebration before they went on a suicide mission. And that was part of what they gave to their family. So anyway, I saw him way over there about 5 miles away from us. And he was about 5 feet above the water and skimming along. Pretty soon he turned around and he came back and he made a run on us way up. And he saw he was going to miss us. That's when I could hit him with a baseball bat. He saw he was going to miss us and he pulled out of his dye. Well, he had a green shirt on and yellow lettering on his back. His cockpit wasn't covered over. It was out there bare. And so he skimmed over the water, he whirled and turned back. He came right up over us, and he started down. And he'd go this way and that way. When he went this way, he was heading right this way, right into my gun mount. The other way, he was on the gun mount on the other side. But he just turned in, and he hit the flagpole. I had jumped out of the gun mount. It was down in, the guy jumped on top of me. I looked up, I thought, well, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I really sat there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to, but I couldn't do nothing about it. I couldn't
figure that this
was
the end.
Yeah. So when he hit that flagpole and flipped over and went on the other side, he went down in the engine room and killed everybody down here in the engine room and fire room. And so we only had one body that was intact. And we got out 3 days later.
Mm-hmm.
We got him out and they dropped him down on the deck. It sounded like a chunk of concrete. I could see a big hole in the back and shoulder,
mm-hmm.
front. Something went right through him. I don't know what piece of metal, I suppose, was heavy. And so it took 3 days to pump all the water out. And so when we finally got the water out, we went down and removed the bodies. But before that happened, there was a I don't like to tell us, but I'm going to. There was one boy came over on the ship to see his brother from another ship. And he wanted to see him. I said, you don't want to see him. He was down there blowed right in the head, floating around like this. His arms was out, his eyes was, you know, fixed. And the guy went down there to see him, and he said, I want to see him. I want to be sure. And he did, and it was terrible.
Yeah. Wish is now he had.
Yes, and I wish he had to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I think about it all the time.
Yeah, I know. You mentioned this before, so I know that about you.
So my brother was on a ship, the Irwin, and he was over the side, screaming pain. And the guys that knew our ship was hit, but they wouldn't tell him until he was trying to find out if I was all right. But he couldn't get that message to him. So finally he told him, says, Jimmy, you was out here on Danville. He has picked up a lot of the prison survivors when they got hit. He said that... They said, well, Jimmy, there's your brother's ship or whatever, you gotta get hold of him. So, he got a boat to come over to see me. And I was all right, thank God. I didn't have a scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And I doctored one boy up that had a bat burn all over his face. got too many serious casualties down there. He's taking care of them. Quick guy got his feet blown off.
Sure.
And so I got the first aid kit out. Went all over his face real lightly, and I said, I'll leave that all in there till tomorrow and see the doctor. His name was Chambers from Birmingham. He'd always say, I'm from Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good kid. And he's only 18 years old, and I'm about 25 at this time.
Mm-hmm.
So he ran around with me like I was his father or something.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand that now. I couldn't then.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, he went to the doctor the next day, and the doctor said, well, somebody took good care of you. He said, I couldn't have done any better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. So he told him what to do. And so he called his, he came out already, he didn't have a scar on him or nothing. I thought he'd all blistered, you know,
mm-hmm.
that he would have some bad burns. But
you should have been a doctor.
I was.
Let's back up just a little bit, Woody. At the moment of impact when that kamikaze hit, was there a loud explosion?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was there fire? A lot of fire?
I was going to bed because I had the gun out and I couldn't see any fire. There might have been, but I couldn't see it.
You
could see it from me because
yes.
of the...
Was there a considerable panic and turmoil?
No, there wasn't. Actually, there wasn't. Everything was calm. And I just said to myself, I wonder why God wants me to live.
Mm-hmm.
And it's bad.
Yeah, it is bad. Yeah. Okay, let's move on. After the impact, and you get, you said it took about 3 days, you pumped water out, got the bodies out.
Mm-hmm.
Then what did you do with your ship?
Well, we was right there for a month. See, we was inside, this is the repair ship. They had us tilted up. Here next, this is our ship, and that's the repair ship. See, they tilted us up so they could pump the water out.
Yeah. So they repaired you right where?
Right there.
Right there.
They welded a 52-foot hole on us. They couldn't work in the, at nighttime because of the suicide plane to see the blowing torches and chair. So they had to do this all at night. And
were you able to go to battle stations and shoot at the enemy?
No, we were dead.
You were dead.
In fact, when my brother came over to see me, we had an air attack. And he said, what we do? I said, well, they told us to go to our lumber and scatter out all over the ship. Don't stay at your battle station, go wherever. And so we went down to my bunk room and stood there for a while, and the attack lasted about 15 minutes. I don't know, I couldn't see what all was going on.
Okay.
And they didn't hit us. But anyway, he was there while we had this attack, and then after it was over, he left and went back to his ship. And that's kind of ironic that two brothers would be that close together.
That's right. Things like that seem to happen during the war. Well, you were there, still in the water, like I mentioned, for about a month. Then what'd you do?
Well, they sent us back to the States to get it repaired. They welded that plate on us, and then we come back in one engine room and one fire room. We went to Hawaii, and well, we went to Saipan first, and then on to Hawaii, got supplies in Saipan.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got to Hawaii, the captain said that anybody who lived west of the Mississippi could go home on leave because we'd gone to Brooklyn Navy Yard and be repaired for the invasion of Japan. And they thought like it'd be about the 1st of November, that's what it was estimated. They couldn't come right out and tell you for sure, but that's what they said. So, there weren't very many, hardly anybody from the East Coast wanted off. And most of the complement of the ship was from the East Coast. I think they only had two or three guys west of the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
So there was room for more.
Mm-hmm.
So I went ahead and signed up to just come home.
When would this been? What date?
Well, I'll tell you, we got hit on June 6th.
Okay.
And we started back July the 7th. That was a month later. They finished this. July 1947, and it took almost until August another one to get on to the States.
Where did you go in the States?
I went to San Diego and got a plane and came home, flew home. And that's the reason why I know that's when the war ended.
Right.
Because I had come home to see my family. And there weren't very many of us, about 8 or 9 of us all together. One was an officer that flew east. And I down to my uncle's to see him. He was sick down in Wayland. And we was listening to the radio there, and the news bulletin came on about this atomic bomb test, or atomic bomb in Japan. And he asked me, he said, "What kind of a bomb is that?" I said, "I don't know. I've never heard of it. That's how secret it was."
Yes.
Nobody knew it except the people that handled it. So I said, "I don't know." So then they dropped the second one. And then Japan surrendered. I just happened to be home at that time. Because our ship was out of commission, we couldn't do nothing. So I was supposed to meet my ship in Brooklyn Navy Yard. So when my leave was up, I think I had 10 days, I went back to the Brooklyn Navy Yard and signed in. And at that time, the Navy had decided our ship was so badly damaged inside, take a new engine room and fire room and get it back in shape, that it wasn't worth the money. So they jumped it. And then they reassigned me, and they said, "Now you can go home, report any place you want to in 2 weeks." So I came home for 2 more weeks. That went pretty good.
Yeah.
And then I reported at the Indianapolis recruiting station over in Indianapolis, and they sent me to San Francisco for reassignment. And I was out there quite a while, and finally they sent me aboard this hospital ship. Well, I didn't know where it was at, so they sent me aboard this ship in, I think it was in San Francisco, yeah, that's where it was. And I went aboard there, and when I went aboard, the guy I relieved was just coming off of the ship. He said, "You're my replacement?" And I said, "Well, I guess so." And he said, "Well, I'm leaving." So he was a pretty mean character. I mean, from all the words I got from the crew, he was mean. And he had no right to be. You just cause you're lost in equal sign, you have to be.
That's right.
So, anyway, I took his place, then we went to Japan. And we got over there about the 1st of November, I think it was. And I was there till the next May. So I went up to the executive officer one day, and I said, "Sir, can I ask you a question?"
"Yeah."
"What do you want?" I said, "I'd like to go down there to McKinney, that bomb test." I said, "I've been out here for the place for so long, I'm tired of it." And he said, "Well," he reached over and tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, "I'm glad that you want to go, because tomorrow we leave for McKinney."
Is that he said, for that hospital ship?
He
said, "What was the name of the hospital?"
He says, "Donald." And he said, "We gotta go back to the States first and pick up some supplies." And he said, "We may have to pick up some bagels, I don't know." He said, "They're talking about everything." So we come back to San Francisco and we picked up supplies and organized our trip to McKinney, which I had to get supplies, food supplies, because I was chief commissary steward. And I had to be sure that we had enough supplies.
You were the chief then?
Yes, I was the chief. I made chief when I went aboard this hospital ship.
Good. And did you find that to be a little better duty than grades below that?
Yeah, when you get first class, you don't have too much to do. You have a lot of responsibility, but you don't have the work to do. Yeah, I only worked about 2 hours a day.
You had to change uniforms too, didn't you?
Yeah, I changed uniforms. In fact, while I was I hadn't been on there for about a month when the supply officer called me down and he said, "Martin," he said, we need a chief aboard here." And he said, "You've been all good to help me." He said, "I come aboard here with you just like you did." And he said, "I didn't know anything about the supply part of it." And he said, "The menus and things." He said, "You've done a good job. You helped me immensely, and we need a chief. So I'm going to recommend your chief." He said, "I got to give you a test." And all it was just a test over my duties I had done since Cook's Town's great. So I didn't have any problem with that. In fact, before I left that ship, he wanted to give me a warrant officer rating. I said, "No." I said, "I'm a leader in the Navy. I don't want a warrant officer rating." Which, now I look back, it's kind of stupid. You know, the veteran. Yeah.
Okay, you're on a hospital ship and you're heading for where they're having the atomic bomb test, right?
Yes.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, they, I think they delayed it one day because of the weather. And so we had orders to cover our eyes during the flash when it detonated, which I did. I didn't want to take a chance on losing my eyesight. And we was in close, and they dropped this. We had about a 3 mile area of old ships left over from the Navy that they wanted to use for testing. This bomb test went off about 3 seconds too soon, which was about 1,500 feet, they estimated. But my goodness, the damage that it didn't do. It just took an aircraft carrier thing and just rolled it back like a can opener would open a can. And so it did a lot of damage to ships. And we went in and looked it over. Really, that was stupid.
Did they drop this atomic bomb to a plane?
Yeah.
Did you see the bomb coming down?
No, we weren't allowed to watch it. You couldn't have seen it, I don't think, anyway, because of the speed that it came down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you could have seen it.
How many miles away were you from where the bomb was dropped?
I think we were about, maybe about 15 miles. And that's what you can see on the horizon. If you're 3 feet above the water, the horizon will be about 15 miles away. And that's like in your backyard, you know. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any protective clothing on?
No, I just wore regular uniforms.
And you had your eyes covered?
They told us to cover our eyes. Until they gave the word that it detonated.
What happened when it went off?
Oh, it was an awful explosion. And I looked up and I saw this mushroom cloud they talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Just right now, it was up in the air about, 70,000 feet. Just mm-hmm. in 3 seconds, it just went up. And it just looked like fire. I mean, like it was a pink cloud.
Did you feel anything there?
You couldn't feel anything.
You didn't feel any heat?
No.
15 miles an hour or any wind?
I didn't, because I was on the opposite side of the ship from where they detonated it. And I looked up and I saw that cloud going up in the air just as fast as it could go. It had to be an atomic bomb to go off to go that high, that
yeah.
3 seconds, 70,000 feet. Mm-hmm. That's moving.
Yes, it is.
And then on top of that, it was the cloud, like a big pink cotton ball, like you see in the carnival, you see these pink candy.
Sure.
That's the way the cloud looked, the color. And we didn't know what was going to happen. We did not know. And you just took your chances like you did during the war.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't afraid of that one as the underwater test that they had.
Tell us about that.
Well, they had the USS Cumberland set off by radio the underwater test they had. They put a atomic bomb over the surface of the water, I don't know how far down. And the USS Cumberland set it off by radio. Well, it just shot up there. You never saw such an explosion of water raising in the air. I mean, it was looked like a mile and a half across up in the air. And you could see them ships floating around up in there. Look, it was little ships in the water. And that was it kind of scared me because when that water came down, there was a tremendous wave come right at us. And about 4 or 5 feet high, and we turned into it. And yeah, I used to be concerned maybe about radioactivity picking it up there. And I know it had to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently it's never affected me any, I don't think.
Did you have any protective eye on that?
No,
we didn't have.
No. But the underwater test was, to me, was the most exciting part, for us to test his concern. And I knew that, and the ships could never travel close together, you know, like they should.
Mm-hmm.
If there's an atomic bomb going to be dropped on, like they have all them ships over there in the desert, storm and in the Gulf, you can't operate that way against atomic bombs.
No.
And I don't know if I'd ever expect to, they can't.
No.
But quite an experience to me. And then they stirred up all the sharks in the Pacific, I think. They were swimming around the ship for days.
Were there dead fish here?
I didn't see too many dead ones, but I saw an awful lot of sharks swimming near the ship. Why, I don't know. But they did. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things that went on that I don't know the answer to. But the thing that got me was all those sailors and crews that went in there to test those goats and animals they had and tested, you know. But I know for sure, one thing for sure, this world cannot use atomic weapons against each other. It's just madness. Mm-hmm. After seeing that,
mm-hmm.
it's just madness if they ever try.
Yeah. It'll destruct the whole universe,
right?
Or the whole Earth.
Yeah.
Civilization will be gone.
Yeah.
Well, what did you do after the atomic bomb test then, Woody?
Well, they brought us back to San Francisco. No, Seattle. They brought us back to Seattle. And we went there. We was there for about a week. And they finally took me off that ship. They decided they was going to destroy that ship to put it out of commission. They took all the crew off. They sent me down to San Francisco. And they reassigned me to the USS Law. I wasn't even commissioned yet. The USS Law is at the destroyer. I laid around there for several weeks. And finally, they said they were going to go shake down cruise in the Pacific. Well, I had all that I wanted. So I said, they had all that 545, I believe it was, come out from the Navy. If you had 4 years of service of certain rates that you could apply to get out. Well, I had about 6 years at that time. Anyway, I went over and signed up. They tried to get me to join the reserves, and I said, no, I want to out, period. And I don't want to go back to the Pacific on another shakedown cruise. Well, I left that ship. I read the paper when I got home after I was discharged. They went to the Mediterranean, and I wish they had stayed on. If I'd have known that, I would have. But I came home then, and I waited about 3 months to get my discharge. And I kept waiting. They always put a list of names out. And I'd go over and watch the list every day. My name wasn't on it. So probably I went over to the office one day, and I told them. I said, I want to know why I can't finally get me discharged. I've been waiting 3 months. And the guy over there, she said, well, let me look and see if I got your records here. So he looked through a bunch of files and finally found them. He said, boy, he said, these records have been here for a long time. He said, why? I don't know. He said, I have nothing to do with posting discharges. And he said, you can be here forever. And I said, I don't want to be here forever. I want to go home. So finally he posted my name, and I was gone in 3 days.
And you came home?
I came home.
But you were discharged where?
In San Francisco.
I see. And then you came back to Montgomery County?
Yeah, I went down to Weaver. My brother lived there, and I wasn't there.
And what'd you do?
Well, my dad saw him out south of town. I came home and worked with him for a while. And I wanted to go into the lumber business and hardware business and get a loan. You know, and he didn't want to work with me. He said he was obligated to his nephews running the sawmill.
Somewhere along the line here, did you get married?
Yeah, I married my wife.
Joanne
Carter. And I met her through her mother. Her mother was a dispatcher down at the Yellow Cab office. Mm-hmm. And she came in one day, and she worked at the ice cream place down on South Washington Street. Mm-hmm. And I married, so we got married.
Did you have children?
Yeah, I have two children. One lives here in Crawfordsville, and one in Carmel.
You have any grandchildren?
I have four granddaughters, and I had a stepdaughter and a step-grandson. They're in Florida, and they've been down there over 20 years. So...
What do you do now?
I'm retired. I worked for Alcoa for almost 30 years.
In Lafayette?
Yeah. And I did live up there for a while, but the kids want me to come back down here to be with them. Yeah.
Well, at this time, we'll pause for a moment. Let's go back to the occupation of Japan. When you went into Tokyo Bay, tell us what happened there during the occupation.
Well, we went in there to, the hospital ship went in there to service the fleet, the sicknesses or whatever, you know. And so we was there from, I think, early November till the next May, till we got ready to go to Bikini. Anyway, I saw a terrible amount of poverty and people just running around with no place to sleep and no jobs, and so many children were dying, and they was carrying them down the alleyways, light blowing on them. They didn't have any good restaurants because they was all done away with. But you'd see maybe some guy would take some old poles and make a three-sided place for people to go in and eat. And then he'd have a big old barrel over the side, and he cooked fish, rice, and everything right in the same barrel and turnips. And that was, you know, that was good eating for those people, which they didn't have much in the first place. And I saw a lot of poverty, a lot of bomb destruction. Tokyo was badly damaged. And Wall Street, you couldn't get down yet, you know, buildings over the streets. I think it was Kobe that was badly damaged too, if I remember right. And Yokosuka, we call it, the name of Yokosuka, wasn't too bad, I didn't think. They had a good officer club there, a place for the chiefs and the officers to go to drink, have a few beers. I did talk to one guy, said he was a kamikaze pilot, but I doubt it. The reason I doubted it was that he just wanted to make me feel good, I guess. His age, they didn't have kamikaze pilots that young or that old. They just didn't, and he was, I figured he was too old to be a kamikaze pilot.
Did you go to downtown Yokohama?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Destruction between Yokosuka and Yokohama. There was quite a lot of destruction.
Oh, yeah.
There.
Yeah. Yeah, the roses. Yeah, there were a lot of buildings bombed terribly. It's just a case of when you have a war and you're bombed, and you're just going to have a lot of destruction, a lot of deaths, and it wasn't pleasant. You know, I'm glad it was their cities instead of ours.
Yeah. Did you run across any famous people while you were there?
Any what?
Famous people.
Oh, well, I did run across, about run over one, Hirohito. We was over to Tokyo one day, we was coming back, we down the Yokosuka, and they were having a tour of the Imperial Palace, the whole crew of people, nine cars they had, limousines, and they had the Imperial Palace on it, and I wasn't driving, my buddy was the driver, and we went and started across the street, and the Imperial Palace came right in front of us. We almost hit it, and like I say, he never budged, he just sat real still, but he never turned his head, just his eyes looked at us, they went right on. We come, but then that far, crashing into him, we just hopped right up against him, and that was the only famous people I met. I used to see a lot of people, talk to them, find out their opinions about the war, and they didn't like Tojo. They hated him. About like we hate some of our generals that got us into the war. That's what happened to them. They didn't want that war. And I felt sorry for him. I felt sorry for the kids. And I used to take gum and candy in my pockets. I wasn't supposed to. I was jeopardizing my career by doing it. And I'd take it out, and I'd get out to the gate, and then they'd see me coming. They knew me. Gun Joe, they'd say, Gun Joe. I'd get the candy out, throw it up in the air. They were glad to see me, but I always took plenty for everybody. I enjoyed that part of it. I never really associated with the Japanese people themselves too much, except, well, they were so disorganized. They really were. And they didn't have anything. No jobs, no food, nothing. Just mercy. I used to go, there was an army base over there, a company of army personnel. They had about 100 mayonnaise, I think. And they come out at noon, scrape their trays. And then Jets used to chip up, knock the trays out of their hand, and scrape what food they could get. And that was sad.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Well, Woody, this has been a very interesting interview. This time, I want to thank you for what you did for America during World War II. And wish you well, and thanks so much for giving us this interview.
Thank you.
Thank you.